Welcome to Recalculating America, a program dedicated to small business in America. Recalculating will help you, the American small business owner, build a new business or help you to grow your existing one. Each week, experts will give you useful information about starting your new business, and you will hear from professionals selected to help you grow your business. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest and has many years of experience helping small businesses build and grow their businesses. Now he is sharing his ideas with you over the air. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money. He specializes in helping small business owners make their money work as hard as they do. Now, your host, Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins.
Dan Perkins here. I'm your co-host along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating, a program dedicated to helping small business leaders increase their profits. We draw our name from the best-selling book, which features the contribution of more than 100 presidents, experts, and leaders, all whom offer ways to grow your small business. Don?
Dan, we have a guest today that I'm really happy to have because I've known him a long time. He's written stories and, in fact, like you, is a contributor to Recalculating the book. Dan, tell us about our first guest.
Thanks, Don. Dr. Kenneth Laher has for many years, followed the economy and its role in improving small business profits. Doctor, welcome to the show. And tell us a little bit about, first of all, yourself, and then how can people get in touch with you with your website or any phone numbers you'd like to share with us?
Well, it's good to be on the show. As you can tell from my accent, I grew up in New York City. But for the last 40 years, I've lived in Houston, Texas, having come here to develop some real estate for the then world's wealthiest Greek shipper, Kostas Lemos, who's unfortunately deceased. When I came to Houston, it was a quiet town. Today, the traffic jams start at 6 in the morning and end at 8 at night. I'm an economist who operates my own small economic consulting company for the last 35 years. Lehrer Financial and Economic Advisory Services in Houston, having obtained 4 degrees, bachelor's, 2 masters, and a doctorate at NYU. And I basically concentrate on servicing and being engaged by small, medium businesses. Many of these businesses, thanks to technology and the fact that people can move around from city to city and interact from city to city on matters like Skype without expensive transportation, now have grown and need the services of an economist, which was not the case 30, 40 years ago when only larger business enterprises were involved with people who did economic studies, reports, and analysis. I also taught finance at the University of Houston for 20 years. As for my personal outlook, I think the president is doing something that is about 20 years too late. You don't wait until somebody gets to be 65 years of age to give them a nice birthday present. You let them enjoy it when they're 45. And a lot of people that won the war for this country and are now passing away at the rate of one an hour or so in this country did not get the benefit of 20 years of the type of change and growth that President Trump is trying to undertake. It's 20 years too late. But they say better late than never, and he's giving it a good shot. Small business can sneak under the radar and make a score. Meaning, if General Motors or IBM or something, a bigger company tries a move, it makes the front page of a newspaper, and they get chastised for it. But if a group of small business people want to change something, they can sneak under the radar and fulfill their goals. And that's what brought about a lot of change in this country, including the PC. They snuck under the radar right in front of IBM and changed the world. Or with cars, some of the manufacturers made smaller cars and snuck under the nose of General Motors. That's what I think the basic contribution is at this moment for small businesses, being able to maneuver and sneak under the radar of the current administration, as the current administration will give them their blessings.
Well, Doctor, lots of great nuggets there for me to jump on, and I'll try and take a few of them, and then we'll give it to Don. I've done some analysis, and there's about 18-plus million corporations in the United States in either subchapter S, C, limited liability companies, or partnerships. There's about 18 million. About 50,000 of those corporations have more than 500 employees. And approximately 8.5 million of the 18 million are 1 to 3 small business, 1 to 3 person small businesses. So the business of America is not about General Motors. The business of America is about me and you and Don, small businesses who hire people, who buy services and do so. I believe, and you may or may not agree with me, I believe that we just came through an 8-year period where the government was doing everything it could to stifle the creation of new business, especially small business, with the outrageous amount of regulations. Trump seems to be wanting to do stuff, but he's doing it by an executive order. It seems to me, Doctor, and you may not agree or you might, we saw what happened when President Obama decided to rule by executive order and not participate with the Congress. Problem I have with executive orders is the next president can turn them over. If we can convince the Congress to take some of the executive orders and turn them into real law, it becomes harder and harder for a subsequent president to overturn them. So
I think,
go ahead.
I think the proof is in the pudding. If you take an executive order and it shows growth and development in America, it'll become part of America. You'll never have to look back.
Mm-hmm.
If there are certain things that need repair, including, shall we say, standardization of internet sales tax, where lots of money is being lost to cities and governments. And a lot of people would like to have standardization of internet sales tax. But Congress doesn't want to do it because they're afraid of voting for a tax.
Right.
So if you could get some executive order that was well thought out by several economists, put into place, and made everybody happy, I think Congress would adopt it, and then they wouldn't have to take the blame for it. They could say we're just doing what the president wanted. And there's a number of these things, including, if you've ever been to an airport, no two airports have the same rules on TSA. No two airports have the same rules on baggage. You need to have things standardized so that this economy, which now runs basically by electronic means and distance between people, they don't have to be in the same room anymore. People are not used to having different rules. They're all interested in having the same rules. And I think that's wasted a lot of money and hurt a lot of small business. You know, if you don't know the rules, you can't play the game.
Right.
And a lot of small business people don't know the rules because the rules are very flexible and they're not formalized.
First quarter preliminary estimate on GDP was 75 basis points, 0.75%. Lowest in several quarters. Aberration, or are we headed for recession?
No, we're headed to see if Trump, President Trump, can lead the Congress, people are just cutting back because of uncertainty. High interest rates are not good. Low interest rates are not good. Uncertain interest rates are the worst.
Right.
You can live with high interest rates if you know they're going to be high, and you can live with low interest rates and some moderate inflation if you know they're going to be low. But if you don't know what they're going to be, uncertainty kills, and business people and small business people, even though I happen to be one, I think are more intelligent than many people that ride the coattails in a large corporation. These people have made the decision to sit and wait to see what happens, and you're not going to see an uptick until maybe Thanksgiving or Christmas, until it settles down and the Congress and the President get on the same page, which should happen, especially if the people start speaking up and they want certain things, and President Trump is willing to give it to them. He's not a politician. He's a businessman, and he knows to listen to his customers. That's how he made the money.
Yeah.
He knew that people wanted middle-class country clubs, and that's where he made a lot of money. Now, Mar-a-Lago is not middle-class, but many of his others, including the one he has in Fort Lauderdale, are middle class. You don't have to be David Rockefeller to be a member.
Right.
They're very nice places. For the upper middle class, they're moderately priced, and he gives the people what they want. He listened to his customers, and he made a lot of money. It's my opinion he's listening to his customers,
right.
330 million of us. Congress isn't. Congress is interested in getting reelected. And since most congressmen only have a constituency of about 800,000 people, they have to listen to that 800,000, and sometimes that 800,000 misses the mark. And that's what's causing the slowdown in GDP, the uncertainty between the two groups.
So let me, would you expect your time frame would be accelerated if they get it, the tax cuts that they're talking about now?
Okay, the tax cuts are really fine, but I don't think you're going to pass them too rapidly because they're very complicated. And it takes time to run models. Like, for example, what happens if you take away or limit the interest deduction on single-family homes? Or what happens if you take away the deductibility of depreciation of automobiles for small businessmen? Or what happens if you cut the tax on dividends, but you do something else? These repercussions, in my analysis, cannot be analyzed in 60 or 90 days, especially when every other 10 days you have some sort of holiday. You know, now you're going to have President's Day or whatever coming up in May, or Memorial Day, and then you've got July 4th, and they keep shutting down.
And you got summer recess.
Right, you don't have a continuum.
Right, right.
You have 10 days of work, and then everybody goes on vacation.
Let me ask you one more question, then I'll go to Don. I don't see how we are ever going to be able to fund for a lifetime the pensions that are on the books in all these government employees, and the inability to do that is going to cause, eventually going to cause, devastation in the middle class.
People are going to have to take a haircut, A, and B, they're not going to be consumer price adjusted. For the last 3 years, Social Security has not received any real increase. It's
right.
been minuscule. But nobody's rioting in the streets. You don't need to give very wealthy retired people a consumer price increase.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the people that are getting these government pensions, that's state, city, and federal, are going to have to take, let's say, a 10% initial haircut and then no consumer price increase except for the very lowest people, okay? Like a person who was a librarian at some small city library might need some form of a consumer price index.
So are you suggesting that they be adjusted based on a means testing?
Definitely, in the long run. Otherwise, you're never going to fund this stuff. It'll be impossible. There's no other way but to means test it to cut off the growth of the higher pensions, because 3% compounded of an $8,000 pension is a humongous amount compared to a 3% compounded growth of a $1,800 pension.
Right.
And if you stop the 3% growth on the $8,000 pension, like the vice mayor or the vice fire chief, and you just stop those compounding growths, you will be able to rein it in.
Don?
What's your take on the national debt, Kenny?
Okay. The national debt passed $20 trillion, according to the Treasury Bulletin, in late December of 2016, and it was the quarterly bulletin was just released. Now, with two things happening, interest rates going up and the national debt going up at approximately $1 million a minute, which is approximately $560 billion a year, this cannot be sustainable. And it's the small businessman that will be hit first, because his reserves are usually much smaller than a General Motors or an IBM. And I think it's up to the citizens to write into their congressman to say, hey, this is important to me. But the problem is that when most people come home at night from a hard day's work with a commute, most people commute to work, they're not in the mood to write their congressman. They got to play with their children, take care of their sick parents, take care of their spouse, do a little homework for their career. They don't have time to write their congressman. And then their congressman says, well, nobody wrote me. But if each congressman, and there's 800,000 people in a district approximately, if each congressman got 30,000, 40,000 letters a month for 3 years, which would be roughly 800,000 letters. Now, I know children can't write a letter, and I know some 90-year-old lady couldn't write a letter, but there's 650,000 people that could write. Then I think it would see some action. But if it's not going to be addressed by the citizens, then I think it's going to be continued to be swept under the rug.
If American industry is going to replace jobs with technology, robots, where are we going to find jobs for the people who want to work?
Okay. The answer to that is you're going to end up dividing a job. By increasing productivity, hopefully you'll be able to pay people enough to live. But instead of having one librarian working 40 hours a week, it should be possible, maybe 20 years from now, to have a librarian work 20 hours a week and use two librarians, but both of them, or each of them, making a living wage. There is just not enough increase in demand for individual talent. Like a dentist. I don't think a dentist is going to be replaced by a robot, but there's just not enough increase in the need for dentists because of fluorinization and better health care. The repair to your teeth lasts longer, so you need fewer dentists.
To our labor costs?
They're all earning enough due to technology, so none of them are on listeners on in financial distress. Let's just say a librarian makes $50,000 a year now, $1,000 a week.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take the librarian's salary and you raise it to $60,000 or $70,000, and then you cut the job in half, you should be able to support the nation, have fuller employment, lower taxes, so that a person making $30,000 instead of $50,000 would not pay as much tax, but have enough money to sustain themselves. That's the only way you're going to absorb people.
I don't see how this country, under your scenario, can take a person who's getting $50,000 as a librarian and probably living close to paycheck to paycheck, by cutting her, taking her the salary for the job to $70,000 and giving her half the time, giving her $35,000, how in the world she's ever going to be able to survive on $35,000 when she was probably just barely making it on $50,000? You could take, you can talk about taxes, but as you cut taxes as a percentage of the total income of the individual, I don't see how the standard of living doesn't go down.
We have to presume that via technology and increased productivity, things won't cost as much. For example, when I was a kid, you used to buy a pair of sneakers called US Keds for $7 or $8.
Mm-hmm.
Today, people buy sneakers for $150.
Or $400.
That's not what I would call a normal price for a pair of sneakers. That's opulent consumption. Now, if we're going to have a nation of people spending $150 for a pair of sneakers, or having three or four cell phones at $400 a piece, then you are correct. That person, that librarian, will never survive.
Right.
However, if you restructure, maybe you put on a consumption tax so people don't waste money, so that they expend their money more frugally and more intelligently, we will have to be able to live, take a $50,000 job, make it 70, cut it in half, and make the $35,000 go further without taxes. Otherwise, with increased immigration, I don't see how it's going to work. There's no other answer I've been able to come up with, but decrease living costs through intelligence and productivity, and pay more in order to spread the work around.
Doctor, I understand what you're saying. I don't happen to believe what you're saying, but I understand what you're saying. I don't see how productivity gains are going to impact the largest single expense of the household, and that's either rent or mortgage payments.
Well, mortgage payments I can help you with, because people are over-sheltering. I wrote my dissertation on cooperative and condominium housing for the purpose of being able to live near where you work, have a swimming pool and a tennis court, and live in about 1,600 square feet. To me, that was the future of the middle class. Many people have disregarded that, and they keep building these homes further and further out in the suburbs with larger and larger square feet, which requires more heat, light, power, insurance, and real estate taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of going the other way, building homes closer in, smaller, with more amenities to limit the amount of rent.
Okay.
If everybody wants to have a mini McMansion and commute, I can't stop them. But that is the wrong way to live for the coming future.
What you are saying is an end to the American philosophical tradition that each generation will subsequently be better off than the previous generation. To convince the up-and-coming generation that their parents who were living in a 2,500, 4,000 square foot McMansion or whatever it is, that you're going to move to 1,600 square feet and you're going to live in an apartment with four walls, is such a serious fundamental change in American lifestyle. I find it hard to find a positive message for the next generation in what you're suggesting.
I'll give you the positive message. Come to Houston at 8:30 in the morning and sit in traffic and go nowhere for 45 minutes. People are starting to think that that's not a better life than their parents. The trick with your nice answer was the word better. More, bigger space doesn't mean better. More commute, more traffic doesn't mean better. There are many people in Manhattan that are very wealthy that live on Park Avenue and Madison Avenue and Fifth Avenue in 2,600 square foot condominiums that walk to work, that think they have a better life than somebody living in a 4,100 square foot single family home with no swimming pool and no tennis court and having to get up at 6:45 in the morning to get to work by 8:30. I think that the answer is, what constitutes better? Does not always constitute better.
And my favorite newspaper, the New York Times, this past Sunday, the article, the real estate article, was the fact that this new generation, the younger generation, prefers to live in transit centers, in smaller apartments and in transit centers where they don't need a car and they have local transportation or commuter transportation. The Times, the whole thrust of the Times article was the fact that what Dr. Blair was saying, that they seem to be forswearing the idea of McMansion. We never even got to Dr. Lehrer's contribution on due diligence for recalculating the book, so I'll have to have him back to talk about that as well.
There are many people, for safety reasons, who don't want to live in a McMansion. They'd rather live in a high-rise condo with a doorman and a security policeman in the lobby and a dead switch on the elevator than live out in the suburbs and having a quarter of an inch of wood between them and a burglary. And I think that the value of the quality of life of coming home from work and not having to cut a lawn, but be able to change your clothes and take the elevator down to the swimming pool, and then walk across the street to the local bar or walk across the street to the grocery store, will have an impact. It might not today, but it will in the next 15 years, as places like Miami, that's a traffic disaster, Los Angeles, I've sat in front of the Getty Museum for an hour, I think it's 4:05.
Yes.
For an hour.
I've been there. Many times. I'm sure you're
a very smart man, but that's not enjoyable day after day.
When the millennials age and start moving up the ladder of success and they accumulate a certain degree of wealth, that high-rise apartment with all the rugrats pushing the buttons all the time, going up and down on all 18 floors, and that living within those four walls, that's going to change with age and maturity and financial resources.
Except for the fact that the real estate taxes on these mini McMansions in order to fund these communities is going to become so excessive that these millennials are going to have to stop and think twice. Not because of me, but because otherwise they're going to take too much of their paycheck for insurance, mortgage, electricity, and real estate taxes.
Doctor,
and
after
a while, it's just not worth it.
You're only talking about half the equation. The other half of the equation, if the property taxes are going to go up on a single family home in suburbia, and real estate taxes are going to go up on the high rise, and what's going to happen is the monthly condo fees to stay in that condo are going to rise because the real estate taxes will be imposed on everybody in the high-rise building.
Okay.
So you can't I don't believe you can avoid rising real estate taxes because you live in an 18-story high-rise. Your condo fees are going to go up. You may not see them in terms of real estate taxes, but your condo fees, and I know places in New York where the condo fees are $700, $800, $900 a month. Condo fee for living, the right to live in that 1,600 square foot or less two-bedroom, one or one-and-a-half bath condo on the 18th floor, condo fees in many places in New York are more than the mortgage payment to buy the condo.
I just want to make a point. In my condo fees, we get water, trash collection, and electricity. So my condo fee might be higher than you would like, but I do get other ingredients that would be paid separately. And I want to add one thing to your little equation. If our school system is not going to continue and more people are going to send their children to private or paid for schools, then via mathematical equation, they're going to have to sooner or later, for the benefit of their children, for a 15-year period, not for their life, but for a 15-year period, give up the mini McMansion. Many parents, including my late mother, often told me the many things she gave up in order to have children. And I think that was a little too vocal on her part, but what she said was the truth, and more people are going to have to give up things in order to raise two middle-class children.
I agree with what you're saying there. I just don't agree that middle-class millennials are going to make those kinds of sacrifices. You could be right, but I've got four of them. And they don't.
That's four more than Dr. Lehrer and myself have. So
yeah.
we'll leave that one for you, Dan. Dr. Lehrer, thank you so much for being with us today.
I've seldom seen Dan
as challenging or as challenging as he's been today. It's been illuminating for me, and I hope for our audience as well.
6 months from now, after the middle class has had a little more exposure to President Trump and interest rates have gone up a little teeny bit more, we can reconvene this conversation for part two, because the outcome will become a little clearer.
Love to do it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Kent.
Thank you.
Don't let hackers get your data. Email is insecure and can't handle large files. Instead, use Biscom's Secure File Transfer product. Military-grade security that's as easy to use as email, and it can handle attachments of any size. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial and make sure your private communications stay private. That's BISCOM.com.
Our next guest is James H. Lee, a long and successful track record in investment management and research. He is a certified financial planner, a chartered financial analyst, and a chartered market technician. He's got a lot of initials after his name. James has gained media attention as Delaware's only professional futurist. Jim Lee has been quoted in publications of the Wall Street Journal, Financial Planning, Medical Economics, and he's written for AARP, the Journal of Future Studies, Technical Forecasting, and Social Change. Welcome, if you would, James Lee. How are you, sir?
Doing very well. Thanks for having me today.
I just have a lot of questions, and I have one that just came across my desk, which I'll throw at you. You know, they talk about balance, and Dan always talks about balance in your portfolio. What's your idea of balance in your in a retiree's portfolio?
Sure. I think the definition is changing, and Dan and I can probably have a great conversation on this one, because we were both sort of raised in the days where, you know, a moderate retirement portfolio would be 60-40, you know, roughly 60% invested in equities and 40% in cash and bonds. And then we had this this thing that happened in 2008 and 2009 where diversification didn't fail. And all asset classes became very diversified or very correlated when you needed that diversification the most, okay? So here we are going on 10 years later, and bonds don't make a whole heck of a lot of sense anymore. You know, getting 3% after taxes, after inflation, you're still coming out net negative. What I've been doing in my own business is I've been focused on equities that generate exceptional dividends, and I've also been focused on tactical strategies that enable me to harvest reasonably stable returns with less volatility than the market. But you've got to get creative, because all the obvious choices have left. Right, and smart money doesn't necessarily know where to go anymore.
There's got to be a lot of people out there who have seen significant degradation of their portfolios, and as a result, finding themselves insufficiently funded in retirement that they're going to have to continue to work.
Oh, you got. I mean, retirement is being redefined even as we speak, and I think some of the conditions that you've talked about in terms of these, you know, three or four really big hits to the market, are one of the reasons why we've seen a flight to more conservative, low volatility stocks. For example, it's part of the reason why we've seen an explosion within the indexed annuity business, where you have insurance companies, in essence, giving you minimum guarantees in terms of future income through their annuity products.
Mm-hmm.
And people are definitely looking for alternatives right now.
But I think I agree with you that people are looking for alternatives. But it's interesting, as we've gone through these three major corrections in stocks and bonds and real estate, and commodities over the last 17 years, people's expectations of what they should earn and what they can earn are dramatically different.
Yes, there's definitely a gap there. And you can't live off of a, you know, $500,000 portfolio as easily as you might have been able to do 15 or 20 years ago, right?
Right.
When I started off in the business in 1991, we were telling people that they could reasonably expect long-term historical returns of 10 to 11% annually, right? And this was kind of normal discussion. And I'm sure that I put together retirement forecasts that had to be redone, because
mm-hmm.
the markets haven't delivered those returns in years and years.
Right.
Meanwhile, you know, I think for individuals, the idea of what we used to think of retirement being, you know, spending time on the beach and with the grandkids and playing golf, isn't necessarily fulfilling to people. So between the fact that portfolios have generally had lower growth over the last few years, combined with the fact that people want to be engaged, they want to continue to do things and contribute, what we're finding is that retirement is getting redefined as reinvention. You get to do something else, right? And I think that's a very positive change that we've had, right? It adds a little bit of meaning, a little bit of fun, a little bit of income too.
I have a retirement strategy where I try and work within retirement plans, and I try and use fixed income investments, dividends on common stocks and dividends on preferred stocks to meet the funding requirement as long as I can. But I tell everybody, you know, maybe I can do this till 84, 85, but the required distributions are going to start accelerating where it's not practical that I can earn the kinds of returns necessarily to keep paying. And your point earlier in the show about returns are not there consistently, but the required distribution percentages keep going up and up and up. So it gets harder and harder to have the portfolio continue to be able to grow and meet the requirements.
That's a really interesting point there. And, you know, if you look at the statistics, some people are saying that half of all children born today will live to the age of 100. And you know, that suggests to me that if you're not doing some of these, you know, retirement projections going out to the age of 95, you might be doing your clients a disservice. Now, what I'm also seeing is, you know, on one hand, you have these government calculations tapping people out of their retirement plans. On the other hand, what I'm also seeing is that the balance of what people have saved towards retirement is much greater than the balance of what they have saved in personal liquid accounts. And because people are getting downsized, outsized, or right-sized, you name it, several times before their retirement, you know, their planned retirement, that in many cases people are completely unprepared for these unexpected transitions, right? And then they have to pull money out of the retirement plans, often paying significant penalties to do that.
Right.
So that is a very common mistake that I've been seeing more and more often.
Jim, I look at the laws that dictate how much you can set aside as a small business person for yourself in a qualified plan. And there are some people who question whether it's really worth it to put money in a retirement plan, especially if you're not going to get a very good return, and then have it turn around and be taxed all of it when it comes out. Do you have any thoughts on that piece?
Well, there are a few different ways to play that, right? One is you do get an immediate deduction when hopefully your income is in a higher tax bracket, and then when you retire or age successfully, you're going to be pulling it out hopefully at a lower tax bracket. There is the benefit of tax deferral as well in the meanwhile. So, you know, I think if you look at what's available to small business owners in particular, you know, SEP IRA plans, you are incentivized to, you know, chunk away a fairly large percentage of your income if you have the means to do so.
Yeah, you can do a SEP IRA, single employee, you can set aside, what, 25% up to almost $50,000 each year
up
into that.
$50,000 per year, yeah.
Don, you wanted to ask
That's
about
huge.
HSA.
Yeah, I was going to ask about HSAs. What did he think of them, and any thoughts he had? Because there, you don't pay tax when you put it in. You don't pay tax with what you earn, and you don't pay tax if you use it at the end for medical expenses. But in between, so I just thought, what you thought?
It's looking like a no-brainer to me, to be honest with you. I think HSAs are vastly undersold at this point, under-recommended, and they're becoming really useful in part because HSAs are now coming with a little bit more in the way of investment flexibility than they used to have in the past. I mean, when HSAs first came about, you had just one funding option, and that was cash, right? And now you have the ability, if you find the right HSA provider, where you can invest that in funds or various index strategies, et cetera, to grow it until you need it. Now, one of the other reasons why I like HSAs as a supplement or as a, you know, complement to your insurance is, one, HSAs can help cover the deductibles and the copays of your insurance policies. And two, you can sometimes use HSAs to cover things that might not be covered by your insurance provider, like chiropractic help, for example, right?
Correct.
So I think they're pretty neat. Yeah.
I think there's a parallel to HSAs that is out there, and that's 529 college savings plans.
Right.
To my opinion, they're still highly restrictive, even though you might get an opportunity to buy Fidelity funds or some Fidelity funds or 20th Century or whatever. But they seem
right.
to be overly restrictive. And the HSAs, while I agree with you in some respects that they've become a little more liberal, I don't think they're as discretionary as you could be with an IRA.
Yeah, well, you know, I think both of those plans, what they have in common, both HSA and 529 plans, is that you typically have a very limited menu of options. You might have just five or six different choices.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of regards, that's very similar to what was available in 401k plans 20 years ago.
Right.
Okay. So now when I look at a company 401k plan, I typically see anywhere between 30 and 50 different investment options.
Mm-hmm.
15 years ago at the same company, there were six. And I think
right.
that's going to happen for the HSAs and 529s too. They're just going to get bigger and better over time.
So let me follow Don's question on HSAs and go back to your futurist. Do you believe that HSAs are going to be an important part of healthcare reform?
I don't know whether it's part of reform, but it's a good way of getting around the limitations of the system, right? It's going to be a useful strategy to cover some of the gaps and the shortcomings of insurance as we know it today.
So if you're a small businessman and you're making a modest profit and you decide you've paid yourself a reasonable salary and now you've got some money, would you put it in an HSA or an IRA?
You're saying moderately profitable, as in just sort of define
that. You're paying your bills. You got a modest salary. You've got excess profits in your corporation or your small business,
mm-hmm.
and you're trying to figure mm-hmm. what I should do. Should I pay it out as a dividend to myself? Should I put it in an IRA mm-hmm. and take advantage of the 25% rule? Should I put it mm-hmm. in an HSA, or should I just take it out as mm-hmm. a bonus?
How's your family feeling, right? What's your health? What's their health? What
mm-hmm.
do they need, right?
Yeah.
Another question is, you know, how are you positioned towards retirement as well? And what's your cash reserve like? Can you cover a medical expense of any significance if it comes along? So I don't think it's a black and white answer necessarily. I think a little bit of moderation, a little bit of funding of both might not be a bad idea.
Okay. The other statistic that I've seen is that one-third of Americans have no savings. One-third of Americans have $1,000 or less, and the other third has the rest. So as Don's talking about, two-thirds of the people could
I have a word for that one.
Okay.
And I refer to that as the donut hole economy, right? In that you've really seen, the interesting thing about a donut is the fact that it has a hole in the middle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what we've seen in the U.S. is the disappearance of the middleman, the middle market, and the middle class, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting a distribution of income such that you have more people that are slipping down the economic ladder, and then you have some people that continue to do very, very well, but there's this hole in the middle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not going away anytime soon, unfortunately. On one hand, you have people with too much time and not enough money. And then on the other hand, you have a lot of people with a lot of money but not enough time. And when you put the two together at a traffic intersection, you know, the results aren't always good.
Mm-hmm. When I asked you what you thought the economy was going to do, you expected it to continue to slow down. If you're right on the forecast of the mark of the economy starting to slow down or continuing to slow down, then the likelihood of that donut hole ever being closed in the middle class through a reaccelerating economy may not happen.
It's going to be tougher. It's not going to be led through consumer demand as it was in the post-World War II era through the early 2000s, right? That was largely a consumer-led expansion of the economy along with, you know, mm-hmm. some of the benefits that we had as sort of the winner of the Second World War. I do believe that economic growth is going to be slower for the next few years, right? I expect that we're going to continue to see pressure on wages. Keep in mind that adjusted for inflation, the average American today is making about 10% less than they did in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at millennials today, the average millennial today, adjusted for inflation, makes 20% less than their parents did at the same age two or three decades ago, right?
So would you, Jim, would you expect, excuse me for interrupting, but would you then expect the chain that has been around for generations, is that the subsequent generation is better off than the previous generation? Are you anticipating that that chain is going to be broken?
That stopped a while ago in terms of economics, in terms of earnings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the other hand, you still have progress in terms of what people have access to, in terms of having access to education, self-directed educational opportunities, in terms of having access to transportation. Even though you might not own a car, you might use an Uber or a Zip car or something along those lines. In terms of having access to entertainment and, you know, distractions and movies, you know, 24/7, there's a lot of that. So what happens with all of this automation, which we talked about earlier, is that you do have an increase in productivity. You do have cost deflation. But on the other hand, people have to compete at a lower value relative to machines. You look at the pricing of content, for example, how much you can rate by writing a magazine article or doing a speech. That's been compressed because in a lot of cases, content is becoming free, and it's getting very hard to compete against that.
Hmm. So in the time that we have left, we've got about 7.5 minutes. Talk to us about your book, Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life.
Now, that was written right after the financial crisis. It's about 5 years old at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did is I took a look at how different generations have adapted to an extended period of economic uncertainty. And I take a look at this on a generation-by-generation basis. First of all, sort of starting with the silent generation, which is my parents' generation, who really were not impacted that much, to the baby boomers, who is becoming the generation of reinvention. And they're continuing to work well into retirement. They're not acting their age. They never did. They never will, right? But they just keep plugging along. You have the Generation Xers, which is my own generation, which I refer to as the do-it-yourself generation. And they're doing more things like homeschooling, maker spaces, home gardening, etc. They're mm-hmm. learning what I would call fierce self-reliance. And then you have the millennials, who I refer to as the first post-consumer generation, right? So this is the generation who saw their mom and dad get laid off from what they thought were lifetime jobs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have gotten so skeptical of the system that if you ask a millennial today how long they expect to stay with their current employer, the answer is about 3 years. And that's it. Nothing more, nothing less. But this is a generation that's absolutely panicked about making long-term financial commitments.
So do you think that what is the next generation after the millennials? What's it going to do?
So that would be the they're still coming up with a name for them at this point. And this is the generation that was born after 2000, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Strauss and Howe, who are noted sociologists, are calling them the homeland generation. They tend to be very focused on security, right? And they tend to be a little bit more cautious than the generations ahead of them, right? They don't have market patterns yet because, you know, frankly, they're still in grade school and high school at this point. So we just don't
know. Some are in college.
Just getting there. Just
yeah.
Starting. Yeah.
So are they going to be the snowflake generation?
Wow. I didn't know I was not the only one using that term, but maybe. Yeah, could happen.
Okay. So we got just a couple more minutes. If I look at what's going on, and I'm following your logic, the importation of less skilled labor and the excess demand of the millennials coming out of college is putting pressure on wages at a lot of different levels of the spectrum as far as opportunity. And I think you used the number, if I heard you right, that the actual wages adjusted for inflation were down over 10% for the middle class?
Across the board, yeah, over the last 15 years.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so are we in a off the deep end here, but are we in a head and shoulders chart pattern for the economy? And if we are, where are we on that pattern?
Yeah, this is a whole new conversation I'd love to get in with you sometime, dealing with a 40-year cycle of expansion and reform, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this has to do with some long-term generational dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
But very briefly speaking, if you imagine a social fabric that connects all of us, that fabric tends to grow over a 20-year period in the form of economic prosperity. That
mm-hmm.
prosperity creates tension and stress, which causes that fabric to tear. And then that 20-year period of expansion is followed by 20 years worth of reform, where you're trying to mend that fabric and stitch it back together. And I believe that since roughly 2000, 2001, we've been in this period of putting things back together, attempting to shed light on a lot of dark places, sending through social reforms, trying to change things, which in turn will rebuild a sense of collective trust and put us on our way towards meaningful, sustained growth by the 2020s.
So that's part of the 20-year cycle that you've been looking at. So we're probably 2.5 years away from the completion of that cycle?
2.5 to 5. It's not always exactly on each decade, but
okay.
We're getting on the tail end of this slow growth environment. Still in the slow growth environment, but I think we're probably going to be getting out of it within the next 2 to 5 years.
Well, Jim, we have to go. Thank you for spending so much time with us. And we enjoyed the conversation. I hope our audience did. And we'll have to have you back. So thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you.
Hate your old fax machine? You can now fax through email. Simply write an email, attach the document, and send. Works with all major email providers. Get rid of the noisy and expensive old fax machine and try Biscom's Cloud Fax. Our solutions are great for businesses of all sizes. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial. That's BISCOM.com.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's show was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. please go to our website, recalculating.biz, for past shows and special offers. And until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success.
Thank you.